We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to episode 289 of the Barcelona Podcast, brought to you by the Blue Wire Podcast Network. I'm Dan Hilton, and with me today is Emil Evanesian. While Barcelona might have one man out of a job, Emil, I always rely on you on that day after. It was a pretty dark place, so I'm going to need your help to try to get me out of that well.
I think I can mine a couple of relative positives.
Yeah, we were talking right before we started recording, just to make sure that Emil and I were not completely 100% on the same page on certain things. But yeah, tactics-wise, I'll get to that in a second. But first, we're going to start with what almost the opposite of what I did last week. This is not a response to the overwhelming negativity of the hashtag Koeman out, of this belief that the manager wasn't good enough. I am going to double down here on the second show of the week that against Bayern Munich, Ronald Koeman tactically did what he had to do to hopefully get a result. I double down with the fact that I think that playing that 5-3-2, playing the 3-5-2 in the formation, the 11 he chose made sense on paper. It made sense based on what Bayern, that everybody in the world knows that Bayern is going to do. They are just an overwhelming force that overwhelms everybody they play, whether it's Bundesliga, whether it's Barcelona. They are deep. They have 17 players that Julian Nagelsmann trusts. And I think that result goes the way no matter what Koeman did. But I think that the tactics he chose for were absolutely right. However, against Granada yesterday, he got it so irrevocably wrong that he took his job status from here are all the excuses that we can lay on paper to even those can't count if you don't have a manager that can do the base minimum and tactically overwhelm at home a team that had not won in La Liga and was looking in bigger shambles than you.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. Because, I mean, I think the Bayern thing was, I remember watching the game and even kind of during the first half, I wasn't under the impression, I wasn't feeling overwhelmingly confident that Barca were going to win or even necessarily get a result. But the first half of that game, it felt very competitive. Barca were attacking. I mean, it was very back and forth. So someone was going to concede at some point. It was a wonder that no one did. And it, you know, kind of the floodgates didn't open in the first half of that game. But I felt like Barca were standing, you know, boxing metaphors, like they were standing in the middle of the ring and they were trading blows. They weren't kind of covering up and just trying to mitigate damage. They were actively trying to make some things happen. And they created some opportunities. They created some openings, whether it was the finishing wasn't there or a final ball wasn't there, but they were making positive movements. There was some of that yesterday as well, but I mean, the level of competition that's on the other side is so vastly different. I mean, that felt, if that had been Bayern Munich yesterday, we might have been able to take some positives from it and find some comfort in some of the things that happened. But it wasn't. I mean, it was Granada. It was, you know, a side that was, like you said, in a shambles. They had what, two draws and two losses in league play this year. And they didn't look like a team that was primed to pull a major upset. Like they didn't look like a team that was ready to walk into Camp Nou and take points. And yeah, so in that sense, it was very discouraging.
Yeah, I feel like I'm breaking two of my held rules or coveted rules here on the podcast, where I don't want to be overreactive to just one result. However, this is a culmination. This being playing a 4-3-3 at home against a team like Granada, you know, by breaking two of my rules, mm-hmm. one, am I being unfair to the manager who just earlier in the week I said had lost Messi and Griezmann right before the season started, does not have the financial backing of anybody, is a club legend that has come to save the club when, you know, he doesn't even have 12 players he can trust. He barely has five players that I would put in a starting lineup for an ideal FC Barcelona. So, I mean, how could you indict him too much based on that? That said, I still look at the squad list against Granada. I still look at Barcelona's 11 and I look at the 11 for Granada. And my other rule that I try not to break is I always try to give credit, especially last year when Barca failed to get that result against Cadiz. It was one of the big ones where I felt like everybody else was a little meaner to Koeman and a little meaner to the team than I was, because I thought Cadiz had a really good game plan. Granada and Robert Moreno did not impress me in any way. The talent on the field was far less than that of Barcelona. And other than getting that goal in the first minute and a half, which was simply because Dest was pushed too far forward and he and Eric Garcia did not have their spacing right, Darwin Machis gets down that sideline. Escudero with a simple, I mean, we're talking secondary school overlapping run and the cross to the far post. That is a simple goal where there's a plenty of players for Barcelona to blame because they hadn't woken up in the match yet. And
it was just a fundamental breakdown.
Robert Moreno thought he could exploit was immediately exploited. The goal was immediately scored. And then they basically played that being Granada a back six. So I was going to do the Koeman's job and then the tactics. Let's switch that up. I'm too fired up. We're going to do the tactics first because it was six at the back basically for Granada for the rest of that game. And they defended for their lives for then 95 minutes. And Granada did not do anything tactically, unlike Cadiz, again, who were changing what they were doing. They were reacting to what Barca were doing last year. Granada were not reacting to anything. They just said, hey, use your wings. We're going to shut down everything through the middle. We're going to put six at the back as close to our goal as possible. And you will not break us down. We are going to clear every one of your 54 crosses. And they cleared 14 of the 54 in the game. That's the one stat that's really circulating. And it's an indictment of the way that Barca were playing. And then 23 crosses in the first half, only five of those were completed. So it's not like they were better in the first half. They were worse in the first half and figured it out, if you will, in the second half, where they went 9 of 31 in the second half. So actually that's a worse margin. Not that my math is too great, but yeah. So tactically, to get outclassed by Granada, I feel like I'm breaking both my rules, but Granada were a team that should have lost that game at the Camp Nou yesterday, and Barcelona's failure to do so. Cause even with a 1-1 draw, it's still an indictment of basically every player, but Ronald Araujo and a little bit of Gabi. And other than that's all you can hang your hat on, because Ronald Araujo had as many shots on target as all of his other teammates.
Yeah.
Because of Barca's 12 corners.
Yeah. He was awesome. I mean, I think taking a step back, the point that you were making about Granada, this was one of those games where the lesser team was effectively spotted a goal. I mean, it was no one even had a sweat yet. And they were up a goal. And I think they almost even played as though they were kind of plus one. They almost played like they were playing with a point spread, in that we're going to make it hard for you. We're going to muddy the box. We're going to make it hard for you. And we're not even going to try to attack. We're just going to try to frustrate you at every turn. Because honestly, a 1-1 draw away to Barcelona is a phenomenal result for Granada. The fact that they'll only be disappointed because the equalizer came so close to the end that you can kind of start tasting the full 3 points and then, you know, you kind of get clipped at the end. But I think this was the objective. It was, I don't know that they wouldn't have done the same thing at 0-0 and, you know, at 60 minutes, if it had still been 0-0, just put yet more people in the box and just pack the area with as many people as you can. Yeah, they weren't trying for a second. It was either going to be a 1-0 victory or ideally a 1-1 draw, but it wasn't really going to end in any other way. Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that I will say, Araujo was fantastic. He was outstanding. I thought Memphis looked good too. The shots didn't find the target. He wasn't dominating the game as such, but he was around the ball and finding the ball. And, you know, at least I know the shots weren't, you know, shots on target are kind of can be a deceptive stat and things like that. But he had a lot of shots and attempts and attacks that had promise. And on another day, he gets a goal or two out of those. And so I think at the very least, he was fighting in a way that I didn't feel like I saw from, and I'm not talking necessarily the effort part, but he was able to make things happen in a way that the other Barca players simply weren't for much of the game until Araujo came on.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you think of great duos, who do you think of? Jordan and Pippen or LeBron and Dwayne Wade? I mean, I talk about basketball a lot here on this podcast, but for the Barcelona version, there's Piqué and Puyol or Piqué and Mascherano, or the easy example of Xavi and Iniesta. And as you can hear from my voice, the perfect teammates aren't just professional athletes. It's cold season. I guess the flu and cold medicine, perfect teammates as well. But in this case, when it comes to growing your business, that's you and Shopify. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. To be honest, I've been doing this show long enough, and as I mentioned, it's cold and flu season. You hear it in my voice, especially during the holiday season. So whenever it comes to this business, anything that I can set up and kind of have working in the background that I know and can trust is just plugging along without my attention, those are the things that I really value at this point. So when my brain is foggy and all I can do is manage to turn on the microphone, talk to the guest, or just talk to myself and get out a piece of content, everything else, having that all automated or working in the background, that's been important to keeping me sane. And that's the thing about something like Shopify. What I do love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. So no matter how big or small, how good of a month or how bad of a month, things are just the same working in the background. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US, and Shopify is a global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs on every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tbpod, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/tbpod now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/tbpod. I was happy with Memphis at times with his first touch. He had a few runs in behind. Coutinho tried to lead him once. Busquets tried to lead him, I think, two or three times. And then there were other times in his first touch would completely let him down. I feel like his first touch was actually better with the higher difficulty receptions, if you will, when it was up over the top, where when he would drop in deep, that's where his first touch actually suffered a bit, when he was actually trying to hold the ball up. And I'd like to have to look back on film and see if for Lyon and the Dutch national team, if he, because we do have him with his broad shoulders, we get the sense that he can hold the ball up well, but I'd love to see, you know, with a larger sample size, if he really is that successful at getting a first touch and holding the ball up, you know, with great success, as opposed to doing all the things that he could do, having that just be one element of his game, as well as picking the ball up wide on the wing, like we know he can do, or running in behind, like we know he can do. But with Barcelona fans and culés for now going on 10 years or 15 years, this concept that teams are going to, you know, sit off Barcelona and defend for the whole 90 minutes, especially at the Camp Nou, when they
teams just let them have the ball and just try to frustrate them.
Right. They just know they're not going to get a point. So for 15 years, Kulik has said, well, how do you break that down? How do you work around that? And a lot of it's based on skill, of course, personnel and technical ability. And I was frustrated where in Ronald Koeman's post game and his press conference, he said that, you know, Barca don't have the individuals to break down a team like that playing through the middle. And he's kind of scoffed at the idea of tiki-taka, which yeah. I think is being overused, overdone. And that term should have been buried 7-8 years ago. Even Pep Guardiola has distanced himself or tried to distance himself from that. I mean, because we're really just talking about tiki-taka as this, it's what the definition has become is it's an ideal of moving the ball very quickly with very technical players through the middle of a defense, and then, you know, winding up finishing it off with some kind of goal that is easy, if you will, a FIFA-esque goal, one that you kind of just
like to walk it into the net type of thing. Yeah.
And yeah, because you've unzipped the defense. And so that's the ideal version of what we're defining tiki-taka as opposed to some kind of system, because people think, well, if Barca are passing the ball well, then they're tiki-taka. And I think that especially for a younger generation, we've kind of lost the whole point of what that system that Guardiola was playing meant. And that system was also predicated on the players that he had, which, you know, when you have a dribbling or a player that has to release the ball after taking a few dribbles, like a Frankie de Jong, who isn't necessarily moving the ball as one touch as you would like, you're not going to play quote unquote tiki-taka in this ideal sense. But that
because you
mean
do have to play to your talent too. I mean, this kind of, you know, dreaming of this ideal that existed with a generation that's no longer there. And you do have to play to your talent a little bit. I know there's a Barca way that everyone's trying to get back to. And I mean, the objective of, you know, the way I always thought of tiki-taka was small triangles, quick, you know, one touch passing, shifting triangles, and essentially you flummox the defense that way and you tire them out. They just get tired of chasing the small passes over, and eventually they have to get it right every time. And when they get it wrong, they leave you an opening. So I understand like where that is a good system to have, but you still, you know, you need the players to play it. And when you have Xavi, Busquets, Iniesta, and Messi at their respective primes, you have the arsenal of players to do that. And
This concept of tiki-taka though, and the quote unquote Barca way is not only ball retention, but ball retrieval. Where Sergio Busquets, if you want to argue a player who played the Barca way yesterday, he had 8 ball retrievals by the 70th minute. And he was putting himself in position to win the ball back against that low block that Granada was playing. And this is my other indictment that, again, it's not just offensively this concept of the Barca way. Yeah. It's where you win the ball. And Barcelona, if they're playing, quote unquote, the Barca way, they are forcing the line of confrontation. And my frustration came then in the second half when Granada pushed their pressure forward a little bit and changed the line of confrontation on a very young back line, which even when Mageta came in for Alejandro Balde, who we'll talk about later, the back line was still 20, 20, 22, and 22. It was still a very youthful back line who, you know, you were going to be able to push, try to put on the back foot, not because that they were scared of playing the ball, because only Araujo is of that core of those four. Araujo is the only one that you're a little nervous with the ball at his feet, but he was playing so well yesterday that wasn't a problem. He wasn't putting himself in any of those dangerous situations, and he was willing to go back to Ter Stegen, who is an elite ball playing goalkeeper. So that should not be an issue about playing through that kind of pressure. And to go back to the ball retrieval point here is Busquets was doing his job. Yes. But my frustration with the tactics did not even come on the wings and with Dest and Balde trying to cross in, or with Coutinho and Demir when they were cutting in. It was that there was no pressure up the middle. You can't tell me technically that Roberto, De Jong, Coutinho, and even looping in 18-year-old in Demir and Memphis, that core of five right up the gut for Granada cannot play through them. The only excuse I could possibly take is that Coutinho started a match for the first time in 9 months and had never worked with Memphis before. And Demir was starting his very first match ever for Barcelona, official match ever for Barcelona. And he's 18 years old. And the fact that Sergio Roberto has only now played his, 7th game back in the midfield since he, you know, for this or for the last 6 months or 7 months or whatever, which for Roberto, I'm completely out of excuses. That said, with Granada playing that low block they did, another point of frustration I had up the middle is that Sergio Roberto and Frankie de Jong, we kind of expect to be making these runs into the box, but because Barcelona were worried about getting caught on the counterattack with the wings pushed so high, they're worried about that space in behind. So Frankie DeYoung's positioning was never really making those runs into the box. It was more shading towards Dest's side to try to add, to try to help on those double teams before Darlan Machis got out off to the races. That never happened. Darwin kept getting off to the races and in behind Sergino Dest. Now, Sergio Roberto was standing almost on the other side of that corner of the top of the 18 box. Yep. And whenever Granata cleared the ball, it would bypass him completely. So he was not in positions in the box very often to be an extra body, to get a shot off. There was one instance where he was at the penalty spot where there was a cutback from Balde where he almost got to that one. And I'm not sure if he was just standing there or if that was a purposeful run. And then the other one from Roberto there was another ball where he winds up making the space for Memphis, and Memphis gets that opportunity because he took the near post run. That was two occasions I saw. The rest of it was him basically waiting to reset the ball and assume that there would be a low clearance that he could immediately retrieve the ball back at the 18. It just didn't happen. And they kept bypassing him over and over and over again. Yep. So Sergio Roberto was, tactically, I don't even blame him for that. There has to be some kind of instruction from the sideline to change that up. And then when Coutinho and Demir would cut in because they both are inverted wingers, it wound up being congested instead of those triangles. The spacing was completely archaic. And the fact that, and I do put this on the manager, the fact that they settled into this idea that one of these crosses will eventually work like it did. Yeah. It's mind-boggling to me that they could not, that seemed to just be the strategy. And you could tell the final commitment to that was PK, Luke DeYoung, and Araujo ending the game as all center forwards. It's not a problem that he tried to change things up. The problem is that it is a confirmation that that was the only idea. Against Granada at home, there was one plan. There was a plan A, and Granada was like, that's their plan A, and that is exactly what they did.
Yeah, so Granada was able to identify what Barca was trying to do, and to the extent that, we want to give credit to Granada, is they identified what Barca were doing, and they did a pretty decent job of trying to shut that down. Because, and I would imagine on the pitch and on the sideline, on the Granada sideline, you do notice at some point that these guys aren't trying something new. They're not hurting us in any other way. You mentioned where Koeman talked about the lack of tactical or lack of technical acumen on the roster that he has or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's true. Fine. That probably is true, relative to Barca teams past. But the fact is you still have hilariously more talent than your opponent, and you have more diverse talent than your opponent. And you didn't devise any kind of creative means of trying to attack them other than trying to brute force them or just put in crosses that weren't, you just said it, they weren't finding their target. One did, thankfully, and so a point was salvaged. But there wasn't a good game plan in there. There was a good play was made to salvage a disappointing result. So I completely agree in that. I didn't get the sense that Barca were going to pivot to anything different. They were doing what they were doing. And, we've kind of talked about, you touched on Coutinho, and, I'm sure we'll end up talking about him at some point. I suppose at the same time, too, I didn't know who I thought was going to make something happen, just in the sense of watching the game. Even when your team is having a frustrating outing, you sometimes have a sense, unless it's an absolute disaster, you have a sense that one or two of these guys, we get them in the right spot, they're looking good, they can do something. I got a little bit of that with Memphis for most of the game, but I didn't really get a sense that there was any Barca players that should be striking fear into Granada's heart as they were on the attack. They just kept doing their job and just battening down the hatches. And that's the thing. They played that game enough. They lost the one time, so it cost them 2 points. But that was really the thing. Barca salvaged a point. We're not sitting here talking about how it's awful. They conceded in the second minute. That really sucks. But, man, they really regrouped well. And it's not a tough luck draw for Barca. They salvaged it. And you have to understand that's seasons and campaigns are made of games like this, but there just wasn't a lot, like you're saying, there wasn't a lot to kind of tactically sink your teeth into and kind of put your faith in going forward.
And therein lies, Emil, my biggest fear going forward is that if I'm Cadiz, I'm looking at what Granada did. And Cadiz has actually basically done that for the last 2 years, but better than what Granada's done so far.
Well, they're kind of a better Granada.
And Cadiz is also doing it at home on first day. So if I'm Cadiz, I'm saying we know the game plan and we can easily execute this against Barcelona at home. Andres Cordero, who does Serie A play-by-play, had a really great tweet about this. He says, Barca's situation feels hopeless in that elite teams will take the ball from them and dominate, while modest teams will happily give them the ball without fear of consequence. And yeah, that perfectly encapsulates why I'm scared moving forward. Because again, against Bayern, I could say, hey, that's a one-off against Bayern Munich. Against Athletic Club, there was a fight, there was a desire, and I thought that they matched Athletic Club tactically well to start the year with that draw. And then even against Adafe, it wasn't great, but enough was done. There was some bright spots to look at. And I'm trying to look at, you know how, and fans of this podcast, I see everybody trashing, of course, Eugenio Dest and Eric Garcia yesterday. You know, I'm going to defend those two, being Dest and Garcia, until my last breath, until the moment that I have to get off the island. I know I'm going to defend them longer than everyone else. For Eugenio Dest against Alejandro Balde yesterday, Balde had four giveaways in his 43 minutes on the field before he came out with that unfortunate back injury. Eugenio Dest had 30. Now, part of this is on the fact that Eugenio Dest gives the ball away way, way, way too much on dribbles and individual 1v1 battles. A lot of that's also on the sheer number of crosses, where Granada said they're going to try to keep flipping this in from the right side, from the left side. It doesn't matter, from Eugenio Dest. And we're just going to keep heading it out because Dest's cross aren't good enough. And so in that game yesterday is the full encapsulation of how I feel about Dest and Garcia and what needs to change before the next manager comes in and they're no longer in the starting lineup. Because if you're Garcia and Dest, I can easily say over and over and over again, they're 20 years old. There are tangible things for them to improve upon. Eric Garcia needs to improve upon his 1v1 defending. He has not played enough. Yeah, I mean, for Man City or whatever, but he's not played enough first team football to actually improve his 1v1 defending against actual, full adult, full grown men.
Yeah, professional. Yeah, top tier professionals. Yeah.
Even in three seasons, he has less than 50 total appearances at a first team level, which, still for 20 years old is pretty good. But in the same regard, with the body type he has, he's going to have to learn the little tricks to get himself where he needs to be with a lack of athleticism. And next to Araujo, his ball playing ability provides you enough, because he really was I'd say, other than Busquets, and you could argue this too, that Garcia had more line breaking passes and was more important to Barcelona of trying to break through the middle than anybody else on that field. So I understand why Garcia is on the field and the job that he does in a positive way, but his 1v1 defending has to improve, because he was getting beat by Jorge Molina. It's one thing to get roasted by Robert Lewandowski, but if you are
right
by 39-year-old Jorge Molina, that is something you have to fix, or else he will find himself on the bench. And I will totally understand why the next manager would put him there. For Eugenio Dest, his crossing has to get better. He's 20 years old. That is a skill that you work on in practice. His crossing has to get a lot better. That's one. And two, his ball retention has got to get better. Yeah. He completely understands the intangibles. I think his 1v1 defending is good. I think this idea that he can't defend is wrong. I think his positioning, he's too far up the field and he doesn't know his teammates well enough. So when you had the first goal happens because Dest gets caught up field and Eric Garcia doesn't have the foot speed to cover for him in behind. And that is a tactical approach to know your personnel. That Dest is going to be out of position, that's fine. Yeah. Danny Alves was out of position a whole heck of a lot.
I was just about to say that, you can do the Danny Alves thing. And I know you kind of mentioned how everyone on the back line was, at most 22 years old. And when you're Danny Alves, or even if you're Eugenio Dest, but you are playing with a veteran experienced top quality back line, you can afford to kind of swashbuckle a little bit more, because you know that these are guys who've seen everything and they know how to cover for this. They know how to sort of hedge to give you an opportunity to get back into position. But when everybody's so young and inexperienced, and also just trying to learn how to play together as well, I mean, these guys haven't spent really very much time kind of learning each other's ticks and developing a hive mind back there, you're going to get burned. And yeah, because Sergiño he's out of position a lot. Like, he's bombing forward a lot. So the point on the crosses, I think, is a very salient one. And I mean, the thing is, I have nothing to add to that. I mean, he needs to get better at that, put in the hours and just keep doing that. Like those have to be, if this is how you're going to play, that has to be better. Otherwise, there's not a purpose for you bombing on this much if you're going to either lose the ball or not cross it well.
Yeah, but
I agree.
Particularly on Deso too, because his skill set, he is so good. And one of the reasons Barca went out and got him is because he's so good with the ball at his feet. He's so good in combinations. And so I do take a little bit of it, not an excuse for him, but he's working with an 18-year-old Dest right in front of him. Demir rather, not Dest, but 18-year-old Demir right in front of him, who he has never played with too. So there is an instance where I do push back on the fact that, you know, that back line of Araujo and Eric Garcia, who had never played together. And then you also have Araujo having to, you know, we know that Garcia is the vocal leader, but Araujo physically has to be the leader covering for an 18-year-old next to him in Balde, who's probably a little nervous, and also dealing with the back injuries that we found out when he came off in that game. So there is youth on that back line. And if I was the manager, I would have started that same back line. This is the moment. That home match against Granada, especially with all the injuries, is when you start Balde, Araujo, Garcia, and Dest. That's the moment you do that. And honestly, they let in the first goal in the first minute and a half, and then Granada decided to defend. But I think there was a belief that there was some confidence being built in that back four, which is a back four that the place of the club is now, unless somebody else is really brought in, you could argue that 5 years from now, that can develop into your ideal, quote unquote, ideal FC Barcelona back four. Now, Dest has to improve a lot. Balde obviously has to improve a lot, and he's 18. Eric Garcia has to get much, much better 1v1 defending, because if not, then, as I kind of said in the match review I did on YouTube yesterday, Ron Araujo is the only one that I would lock in and pencil in as being a, you know, Champions League starting winning center back in 5 years from now, or along that back line, I mean, unless the other three really, really improve. But they're the
I don't know about 5 years. Yeah, 5 years from now, I know that's, but right now, Araujo is the one that I trust. And it always comes down to, and you can say this about any sport, whether it's, you know, American football, basketball, whatever. Like there's guys who are put into whatever the middle of the conflict of the game, whether it's having the ball or having to defend or something like that. And this is a little bit of very kind of subjective and kind of feelings based analysis, but there's a gut feel when you trust the guy that has the ball. You know that he's not going to give it away, and at the very least he's thinking through the situation, and he also has the sort of the physical and technical acumen to handle whatever comes. Araujo is the guy that I trust in yesterday's backline the most. Dest, I think, has of the other guys, Dest's ceiling and full complement of skill set is my favorite, and I want it to be realized, because if it is realized, he is sacrilege to ever say, you know, you would never say Dani Alves, anything like that, but he's a guy who can at least sort of mimic that role. He can study that role and do his version of it, his interpretation of it. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of room for, there is talent, but there are just glaring flaws. And the problem is too, in many cases, the guys, the inexperience combined with everyone's respective, you know, fatal flaws in their games right now sort of conspire to put the side in really tough spots. When it goes wrong, it just really goes wrong, because it's almost the perfect set of shortcomings to create a problem.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and that's where on the reverse side of this, we do try to be a little bit positive about some of the youth, because the final two, we'll say, points on the match would be Alejandro Balde. They said with those four giveaways, working with Coutinho for the first time in his career, getting a start at the Camp Nou. Yes, he had to come off with the injury with the back, but even when he went to have that discussion with the medical staff about his back, about coming off in the 42nd minute before the Camp Nou, you know, they booed Koeman for it, but before they knew he came off injured, it seemed like there was also an instruction that he had to get infield a little bit more. He had to invert himself. I think he was a little nervous to do that, just because he wanted to kind of stick with what he knows that he does well. He also was, I thought, pretty good with his defending 1v1 as well, which is something that is his big worrying point when you watch him at the lower levels. That said, Alejandro Balde, I think, could be very happy with the debut he had. Mm-hmm. I was happy with it. And if he could just kind of carve out and figure out, hey, I can contribute to this team in year one, I'm not expecting him to reinvent the wheel at the left back position and take over Jordi Alba this year. I mean, he's 18. Mm-hmm. He's still registered with the Juvenil A's. He could be playing in the U19 UEFA League. So I'm going to be really patient with him. And I think we should be. But I thought that he did not look out of place. And that's all I'm looking for with an 18-year-old player. Same thing with Demir. Demir looked not out of place, and I'm fine with that. Gavi, not only did he look out of place, but he impacted the match, not only with the assist, but Gavi should start against Cadiz. On the road, I don't care. Two chances created in 30 minutes, 18 successful passes. Yeah, that's not much, but he was also on throwing 30 minutes. Three ball recoveries, one tackle, and then the assist, which was a one-touch cross into Araujo after the feed from PK, just and lofting it over the two defenders, getting to the back post.
Perfect cross. He put it exactly where you needed to put it. And I mean, I think with him, I feel like it's time. He needs to be part of the, I don't mean starting every match, but he needs to be part of the rotation. He needs to be playing real minutes and starting, because he is going to have a spot in FC Barcelona's first team. I'm increasingly feeling like sooner rather than later. Yeah. And so he's not overawed by the moment. He's not technically incapable. I mean, we were talking about Balde. I think the biggest thing with Balde is it's experience. And you said kind of the comfort and confidence, because I think when he gains confidence, and that will be born of experience and playing with senior pros and playing against senior pros, I think the physical stuff and the technical stuff, I don't worry so much, because he's only 18 years old. He's going to physically mature a little bit more. But I think as he gains confidence and he learns more through experience, I think with him, I don't really worry very much at all. I mean, I really hope this injury isn't serious, because I hope he's able to come in and log meaningful minutes this season.
Yeah, before Alba once Alba comes back, it's over, because every manager, either a new manager or Ronald Koeman, is going to be managing for his job here on out.
Exactly.
It's always going to be Jordi Alba. It's always going to be Busquets. It's always going to be De Jong and Pedri. And that is the one worry now, because the manager's job is so up for grabs. But yeah, that's what we're going to end the show with. But yeah, continue your point.
Yeah, but I mean, that was kind of the thing was, I mean, with him, it's not even really a concern as much as it is, I look forward to him getting minutes. And I mean, I guess to the extent that I have a concern is that, like you said, I hope he has the opportunity to log those minutes and gain that experience, because it's the confidence gained from doing good things. It's, you know, even the confidence gained from making mistakes and learning how to deal with them and being in that heat of battle. Yeah. And I mean, but I think with Gavi, I think it's exactly like you said, the midfield, particularly with Koeman, as long as he's now, I mean, really under fire, he's going to play whatever he deems to be his best 11 or his best midfield, his best unit as often as he can, because I mean, it's tenuous for him. It's not looking great.
Yeah, I mean, these abstract ideas that people throw out of like picking a lineup, like, oh, Roberto should never play again, or da da yada yada yada. If Barcelona are playing Real Madrid tomorrow, I totally understand starting Sergio Roberto, Frank de Jong, and Sergio Busquets. I totally understand against Real Madrid why you would even set up with that way. I mean, because Sergio Roberto is not a net zero in midfield. He has a skill set. He does certain things. And the things that he does is he moves the ball laterally. He helps create a bit of space in the midfield, especially if the other team is trying to play out with them. And his ball recoveries in open space are better than that of a 17-year-old in Gavi. That said, against Cadiz, Gavi's skill set at this level, even at 17, is more complementary of breaking down Cadiz than what Roberto's skill set is. So to me, that's why I've never been able to understand it. And the same thing even with the Ricky Puig thing. There are time and a place for Ricky Puig. And it always seems to be in the last year and a half, under Koeman at least, that when the team is down, then you need to add this wild card and throw everything everything on the painting, on the easel. You throw everything, all the paint you have. And that means that Ricky Puig is going to get dusted off for those kind of opportunities. But, you know, clearly I agree. Tactically, defensively, rest defense, he's way behind Gavi and he's 22 years old. And so there are things and worrisome signs that it's understandable why he's not starting matches, especially when Ronald Koeman is managing for his job. But in the same instance, there are teams like, again, a Cadiz, where Ricky Puig is not going to be the reason you lose a match to Cadiz. You should be beating Cadiz. Even at home, Cadiz, Barcelona should be beating Cadiz 2-0 or 3-1. And even if you allow Cadiz to get a goal at home because Ricky Puig got beat up through the middle, the number of chances that he's going to create because of how bright and important he is on the ball moving forward and the amount of space that he creates with his passing to unlock Cadiz is worth the risk. And that's
that should be a net positive. About.
So it's not a Ricky Puig needs to start or Koeman's hating on Ricky Puig. It's that there's a time and a place for these players, even with the limited players he has. And the 11 that was selected against Granada, again, I mean, I would have picked the same four at the back. That was a young back line, but at home against Granada is when you start those four. And I understand the midfield, but that was a change that had to be made. And I know it stinks if you're a captain of Sergio Roberto to come off in the 40th minute for Gabi, but I mean, Koeman is now, and he knows that he is managing for his job, and this is how we're going to end the show here. It is, I felt like against Bayern Munich, we were at what, like a code, I don't remember the codes, and they're silly, and it's about American terrorism, but anyway. So I think we were at like a code yellow, if you will, and now, I mean, now it's code, what, vermilion? I know it's not
black, often color, I don't know, just like, yeah.
And
just,
orange, it's not code even, I think it's not code red.
Because red was the bad one. So
yes, but it's not a code red because there's no immediate replacement to immediately take over. It's not like, unlike if it was Victor Font who was president, you don't know that Xavi is going to walk in through that door the very next day and take on the project. So it's as code orange. I think it's as code red as far as his job security, but it's as code orange as when he's going to get relieved of his duties, just due to the fact that Laporta's choice is Jordi Cruyff. He has said no. And then all the other names we've had thrown out there, Robert Martinez, and these change by the hour, but Robert Martinez for the Belgian national team, Erik ten Hag is not coming from Ajax. Andrea Pirlo, of course, flamed out when he was a club legend at Juventus as the manager coming back, and that already didn't work out. Antonio Conte is a free agent, and if Kules don't want to see Ronald Koeman at the helm, I can tell you that Antonio Conte's tactics are not going to make anybody happy. Is not going to lead Leeds. Xavi is... And that's the really one we're questioning and talking about. And then Philip Koku, he's another, well, it's like quote unquote club legend, but he's not. He's, you know, one of the top 50 players.
He's of the club to an extent.
Of the club. A former Dutch, not even former, but he's a Dutch manager who was last with Derby County in the championship. And that didn't really work out so well. And then Garcia Pimienta, because he was let go, can't even be an interim. And he's not the choice. He's now working for Cadena Ser. That's why we keep saying all the stuff from Garcia Pimienta and all these comments. So I gave you that whole list. But it seems like there's a lot of, well, this is why this guy won't work. This is why this guy won't work. This is why this guy won't work. And it seems like the reports that I believe that the next guy is going to be for the long haul. How's that going to happen if Koeman isn't let go in, not even January, but at the end of the season?
Well, my presumption is that he's going to get the season for the simple fact of what you said. There's not an in-house replacement. That, you know, like you said, whether it's Pimienta or someone on Koeman's staff that, you know, is rumored to be, you know, really working well with the players and, you know, might be a bright up and comer or something like that. So there's not an in-house replacement ready to go. And then, like you said, so Ten Hag and Roberto Martinez are probably happier. I mean, almost certainly happier in their jobs than they would be stepping into this Barcelona at this moment. And particularly Roberto Martinez, you know, for all of his shortcomings as a manager, he's got a legitimate shot at winning a World Cup next summer. I don't imagine he is going to walk away from, or, you know, next, whatever it is, next Christmas or whenever we're doing that. But I don't imagine he's going to walk away from the Belgian national team. Erik ten Hag's not coming. I don't know why. I mean, the Andrea Pirlo thing, you know, just, he wasn't even good. He wasn't good at the club that loved him. So that would just, I feel like that would just be an absolute just train wreck here. Look, Antonio Conte, I think the world, the kind of Kules and the club and everybody, if everyone's just kind of making a practical business decision and he essentially comes in as a long-term interim sort of thing where
I don't think I can handle it.
Oh, I look, it would not be fun, but at the very least, I think the results would pick up. So I think it would be, But I think it would be a practical decision in the sense of, okay, this guy is absolutely going to, like, it's going to grind. It's really going to grind us into dust here. But he's gonna get results, and we're going to at least you know, sort of secure the league position, that at least something I, you know, acceptable to potentially good. And in big games, he might be able to kind of tactic us through an extra round of the Champions League that we might otherwise not have gotten through, type of thing. So, because it does feel like everything's just holding I feel like this whole thing is just keep the seat warm until the World Cup in Qatar is over and Xavi comes. Like, I feel like that's the inevitable culmination of all of this.
But are we to believe that Laporta isn't really totally sold on Xavi?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much of it is that, and I don't know how much of it is potentially like the political stuff, because Xavi was Victor Font's guy, mm-hmm. and Laporta didn't have the same... He essentially didn't campaign on, I'm going to make Xavi the manager and, you know, kind of restore all the happy vibes and everything. So I don't know where Laporta stands, you know, in his heart of hearts on Xavi as a manager. But I think I don't know if it's a consensus, but the prevailing opinion seems to be that Xavi is in line to do this. He, you know, he's paying his dues and, you know, doing his managerial work. You know, it wasn't like a Frank Lampard or Andrea Pirlo situation where with minimal experience, they immediately were installed at, you know, one of the biggest jobs in their, you know, in their home nation. Because the question also comes down to, if not Xavi, then who?
Yeah. Well, so let me just ask you, I mean, I'm going to continue talking about this later on the week, and
yeah,
this story is not going to go away. It's September. And so until Ronald Koeman loses his job and he's replaced, this is going to be a talking point, because I think we have reached that point of no return. You know, I understand why I would want a club legend like Ronald Koeman to get what he deserves, in that, like, I would want him to be treated fairly on his way out. I would hope that the situation with Quique Setién, because even though Quique Setién was completely underqualified for the job, the way in which that all ended was totally unfair to him personally. Yeah. And, you know, you could almost argue the same thing for Ernesto Valverde, where Messi and the team.
Oh, I do argue the same thing about Ernesto Valverde. Yeah,
he should have been let go. I mean, the prior summer. And so for Ronald, I mean, there is a moment.
Or when they let him go, he should have gotten the rest of that season.
What I'm saying. He either should have finished the season or had been let go the prior. Or the summer even before that, after the Roma, which would have been But for Koeman, he needs to be relieved of his duties, and he knows it too. The way he speaks about the job, he understands that he's not in it for the long haul. He's not going to be managing this team to a Champions League victory. I've been saying it for a while now, but it is just September, and if he finishes out this season, boy, I mean, something has to happen. He's going to have to really change something around, or I don't know what needs to happen. The only thing I can think of is Ansu Fati is apparently supposed to return against Levante, and if Ansu Fati comes back against Levante and somehow results change and results pick up when you have one of the top 10 best players under the age of 20 or 21 in your squad returning, and, you know, this bright star who's been out for a year returns and galvanizes the team a bit, then it could basically keep him in his stead until January or June. And that means if the club finishes or looks like they're going to finish between second and fourth in the Liga table. And that is where expectations, I think, are pivoting to a little bit, because, you know, I know Kules would love Eric Ten Hag, but again, that's not going to happen. And no one else on that list, even a Robert Martinez, I know, with Belgium, he's had this talent, but he never showed me anything at Everton. And other than being born, I don't know what makes him a favorite for this job other than being born in Catalonia.
No. And that's kind of the thing. He's gotten phenomenal jobs, and I know he was, what was it? It was Wigan, right? Where he was like, they were great. I think they won the FA Cup.
And then he did well with Swansea City comparably as well, too. They kind of parlay into the Everton job, but.
Yeah. But then from there, when he's gotten anything even resembling sort of bigger club and more resources and stuff like that, it's never felt like he's gotten, never mind more than what you would expect out of the resources at hand. I mean, I don't even know if he's fully maximized the talent and the resources that he's had at hand, whether it was at Everton or, you know, I mean, you could even argue with the Belgian national team, just what he's got. And I know he was a huge upgrade over, because I guess they hated Mark Vilmots, who was there before. But yeah, I don't know how he sort of gets a front row seat in all of these conversations. And I know he was born in Catalonia, but yeah, I mean, Ten Hag would be the sort of the ideal scenario, but I mean, he's not coming. Like, it's just, I don't know why he would, I don't know why he would do that.
Yeah. The other thing you have to look at too, the other two big factors here, Emil, as we wrap the show up is one, the price, because of the financial situation the club is in, the cost of getting rid of Koeman at this juncture apparently is anywhere between 12 and 14 million euros.
But
in the court of law, the club still might owe Setien between 14 to 18 million euros based on the way that his contract was ripped up and thrown out the door, and he still owed money. So it could be A, the club, you know, put itself more in a financial hole by paying a new manager and having to pay to get rid of Koeman. And then, but part two of that is if he has lost the locker room, and that was my fear yesterday, that there have been people saying Koeman out since, you know, last January or last,
it's practically day one.
Yeah, you're always gonna have a subset. As they always wind up tending to be younger as well. So there's always a subset of the fan base who just, if you don't win every match by eight, it's Koeman out. You're done with him.
Yeah.
But I got the sense yesterday in that game that we knew that Laporta wasn't always favoring, and he's not the biggest fan of Koeman. But if he's lost the players in that locker room, and not just the Los Amigos, not just the captains in Alba and Busquets and Roberto and the old, you know, the sacred cows,
the old guard. Yeah.
If he has lost everyone in that locker room, if he has lost the locker room completely, then you can't move forward with him no matter what, because the only people that really need to be receptive to him are the people who, you know, basically signed his checks and those who are listening to him to try to get results. And if he's lost them, regardless of what the fans think, if he's lost them, then we've lost the point. And now we're off the mark, and he's got to be replaced in some way. But yeah, unfortunately, Garcia Pimienta can't be an interim until the quote unquote right guy comes. But September, the third week of September is just an awful time to try to replace your manager, because everybody else has now gotten cushier jobs, or that coaching merry-go-round has stopped for the beginning of the season.
Right. Because most people who got new jobs for this season, by and large, unless it has absolutely burst into flames right away, someone who started a job prior to this season, few of them are on the chopping block, you know? And so any of the candidates that you might've been looking at last year who found a seat, they're not on the market right now. And then, so you go to, what do we have in-house? Who's available in the market? Because also you don't have it's like you said, it's astounding that there's always some sort of new financial calamity around the corner, like the Setien thing. It's like every rock you look under, it's like there's a new like 20 million euro liability. But I think there's no one in-house that you can just simply promote. And who's currently looking for a job that you'd want to bring in? I mean, objectively, Conte is the best coach. That would end in tears. And I don't even know. I mean, where do you look? So, I mean, I think that works in, you kind of alluded to it, in that the situation is super dire, but the lack of alternatives, I think, artificially gives Koeman a little bit of job security.
Yeah. And I think the excuses he's making are, I have all these injured players.
Yes.
And even against Granada, I would have loved to use wingers in Dembele and Ansu Fati, but they weren't available to unlock that defense. That was the excuse he made. I broke down in the middle why I hate that excuse, but that was the excuse he made. He's saying, wait until I get my players back, because missing Griezmann.
Look, that's literally true. And I do understand that it would be nice for everybody to be at full strength. It'd be nice to have the full strength squad and actually see if there is some sort of grand vision that Koeman has that would be unlocked if the full complement was there. Look, the one thing is, you sort of alluded to it, Ansu needs to come back to save Koeman's job. And I mean, like, truly save it, and not simply we don't have anyone better. Ansu Fati needs to come back and, I mean, almost just be a revelation. You know, I think it's a quartet of Fati, Memphis, De Jong, and Pedri that will save Koeman's job if it's to be saved.
Of course. You're talking star striker Luke De Jong, of course.
Oh, clearly, yeah. Brathwaite 2.0, yeah. You know, to be fair,
don't. Come on. You don't have to. We're talking back. I think we've gone too far.
I know. I was about to go afield. But yeah, I mean, but those guys are going to save his job. If it's there to be saved, and if he hasn't lost the dressing room, like you said, if Ansu Fati comes back and he's at full strength, that quartet can paper over some cracks. Like, they are that good individually and potentially collectively. So that's what it's going to have to be.
Well, but that's the point, right? You don't deserve your job if you cannot take that kind of talent and finish top four in the Liga and get a championship.
Right.
That's the problem, right? So, all right. So that wraps up another edition of the show. Yeah, I mean, people who come here for your positivity, I don't know, is a different flavor today. I was a little cranky. I wasn't personally cranky. I'm actually working, trying to bring up, this will be a long ongoing saga. I'm fighting a tree trunk in my backyard, and it's a lot bigger than I thought. And it very much, as I'm out there for hours working on this tree trunk, it is looking a lot like the situation FC Barcelona. The deeper I dig, the more it's stuck into the ground, and the more problems
more
I have
to dig up.
It's too heavy and I'm sweaty and it's just a mess. And so it winds up being a perfect analogy for what the club's going through. But yeah, this is a weird one. This is a cranky one, but you know, you can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at the Barcelona Pod for some positive stuff or for when this turns around. You can also join our closed Facebook group and share the tears and share the hugs. That's the Barcelona Podcast. Answer the questions, let you in. And on Patreon, that is how we continue to financially support these shows. Really, really appreciate that. And then we're also on YouTube with those match reviews and some other fun stuff over there at the Barcelona Podcast. Thank you so much, by the way, on YouTube, 7,000 subscribers. So thanks for all 7,000 people on the march to 10,000. Maybe I might do something special for 10,000. So yeah, incentivize your friends. I don't know. I'm not allowed to do it, but I don't know, share it like or something. And yeah, we'll get 10,000 and then we'll see where we go from there. So most importantly, though, thanks to all you for listening to the Barcelona Podcast here in the podcast format. Until next time, we'll talk to you soon. Forza Barça.
Forza Barça.